From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a couple of our favorite singers. We talk with Abby Lincoln about why she only performs songs with lyrics she believes in. And we hear from the singer Frank Sinatra once called the best in the business. Tony Bennett tells us about his more than 40-year singing career. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, The Ballad of Little Joe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A top Israeli official said today that the plan for Palestinian self-rule in the occupied territories would not include a so-called right of return for Palestinian refugees. The issue could be one of the most contentious to face the two sides. More than 800,000 Palestinians fled the occupied territories after the 1967 Middle East War. Israeli defense official Mordechai Gur said today that Israel will not allow a mass return of refugees. According to the draft agreement, the refugee issue could be raised in negotiations on the final status of the occupied territories to begin 2 years after self-rule. As Armenian forces continue their offensive in western Azerbaijan, Turkey and Iran have stepped up diplomatic and military pressure to stem the tide of Azeri refugees and to get Armenia to withdraw from the land it's recently captured. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
According to statements issued in Turkey after an emergency cabinet meeting to discuss the conflict in Azerbaijan, a government spokesman reiterated his concern about Iran's decision to amass troops along its northern border. Iran's frontier is less than 10 miles from Azeri towns, which have been attacked and emptied by Armenian forces. The Turkish spokesman said that Iran's troop buildup was approaching a dimension which would seriously threaten regional peace. He said that Turkey, one of Armenia's historic foes, was taking new unspecified measures to protect the territorial integrity of its struggling ally, Azerbaijan. American concern about the border tension was also discussed in Ankara yesterday in talks between Turkish foreign ministry officials and the U.S. special envoy for the undeclared war over Nagorno-Karabakh. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
In West Palm Beach, Florida today, a black man who was deliberately burned identified two white defendants as his assailants. Bobby O'Brien of member station WUSF reports.
Leaning forward in the witness chair and nervously licking his lips, Chris Wilson told the jury how he was abducted while buying a newspaper New Year's Day. A gun poked into his ribs, Wilson was forced to drive to an isolated field outside Tampa. During the drive, Wilson was taunted by racial slurs from the assailant Wilson nicknamed the Mean One. Wilson later identified Charles Rourke as the Mean One, the one who splashed him with gasoline. He'd previously picked out the other defendant, Mark Kohut. If convicted, the two defendants could face life in prison for attempted murder, armed robbery, and kidnapping. For National Public Radio, I'm Bobby O'Brien in West Palm Beach.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 3,634. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in active trading. This is NPR. Bosnia's Muslim president, Alija Izetbegovic, is scheduled to address the UN Security Council next week following the breakdown of the Bosnian partition talks in Geneva. The Security Council urged that those talks be resumed, even as new fighting broke out in central Bosnia and in the southern city of Mostar. Izetbegovic is holding out for more territory when Bosnia is divided up among Serbs, Croats, and Muslims, and he wants a corridor from Sarajevo to the Adriatic Sea. Izetbegovic is expected to seek support for that position from Security Council members. Angolan rebel leader Jonas Savimbi says he's ready to agree to a ceasefire in the country's renewed civil war. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports.
Portugal's President Mario Soares said today that Jonas Savimbi told him he is ready to implement a ceasefire in Angola as soon as the United Nations can set a date, according to Reuters News Service. Savimbi also told Suarez he would be contacting UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali to officially inform him. The rebel offer may represent a breakthrough in repeated international efforts to end the fighting in Angola, which has claimed an estimated 100,000 lives since January. The civil war resumed when Savimbi refused to accept his defeat in the country's first democratic elections last fall. Since then, Savimbi's UNITA rebels have seized about 75% of the country and refused repeated offers to end the fighting. But a recent government offensive has rolled back some rebel gains, and there is concern that the government may be reluctant to agree to a ceasefire now that the military balance has shifted in its favor. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The nation's unemployment rate dropped by another 0.1% last month to settle at its lowest level in more than 2 years. The Labor Department reported that the jobless rate fell to 6.7%, but that the number of non-farm jobs available actually shrank. Non-farm payrolls were down by almost 40,000 jobs. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Abby Lincoln is one of the most emotionally gripping singers I know. That emotional depth comes through whether she's singing jazz standards or her own songs. Lincoln started her career in the 50s on the supper club circuit. She left that world after meeting the innovative drummer Max Roach, who she later married. In 1957, they made the first in a series of records together, which featured Lincoln backed by such jazz luminaries as Sonny Rollins and Eric Dolphy. Lincoln's songs began to reflect her growing involvement in the civil rights and black pride movements. Since 1990, she's recorded for Verve. From her latest album, this is the Frank Lesser song, Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year.
Spring will be a little late this year. A little late. Arriving in our lonely world over here, 'cause you have left us, and where is our and winter continues cold, as if to say, spring.
Abby Lincoln, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me why you wanted to record Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year.
I chose Spring Will Be a Little Late because it really is a brilliant song. It's wonderfully written, and it had the thought that I wanted bring to the album, one of the thoughts. It's something that I think a lot of people feel, a little disappointment and anxious for another time in our lives.
The song that we just heard is a standard, but in concert and on records, a lot of the songs that you sing are your own songs now.
Yes.
And I remember I interviewed you once a bunch of years ago, maybe 10 years ago, and I remember very clearly one of the things that you said. You said that at a certain point you stopped singing songs that had lines like, he beats me too, in it, because you felt that you lived the lyrics that you sang and that you couldn't afford to sing abusive lyrics like that anymore.
Yes, well, I know that Billie Holiday, I was following in her tradition, you know, and singing the songs that I'd heard her sing, and Dinah Washington and some of the other singers. But when I discovered that, as you said, a song is a prayer, and sometimes it's your own reality, and maybe it will be your reality in the future if you continue to sing it. I never experienced a relationship where a man beat me. And I thought, what am I singing this for? I don't want to live this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let me play one of the songs that you wrote that you recorded on one of your recent albums. And this is called I've Got Thunder
Yes.
And It Rings. it's a great song.
Thank you.
Tell me something about writing it, about what you wanted to say about yourself in this song.
Well, there's a complaint about the woman, about the female, you know. especially about black women. I don't know. I guess it's the same thing for all the women. But if you express yourself, they say you talk too much and you don't know how to be feminine and you're a drag, you know? So I said, listen, this is all true. So run. Because I'm not changing anything. I'm everything that you say I am. So don't come around here. Because love is an emotion that'll move you to do things, to say things, and to be things, whether it pleases anybody or not.
Well, let's hear Evie Lincoln singing her own song, I've Got Thunder and It Rings. And this is from her album, The World is Falling Down.
Some folks talk about my power. Some folks say I'm wild and strong. Others say my style of living makes a man go wrong. I'm a woman hard to handle. If you need to handle things, better run. When I start coming, I got thunder and it rings. It'll move you to do things. Love is an emotion. It'll move you to do things. I got thunder and it rings. Some folks talk about the love they're feeling.
That's Abby Lincoln singing her own song. When you started your career as a singer, you worked as a glamorous nightclub singer, evening gowns, the whole bit. As a matter of fact, one writer described you as being packaged as the Black Julie London. Do you think that that's appropriate?
No, they used to compare me to Lena Horne. At that time, everybody was trying to be beautiful as Lena Horne.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Eartha Kitt, who was supposed to be a kitten. And you were supposed to have a glamorous image. And there was Marilyn Monroe. It was Marilyn. I wore a dress that they said she wore in a film called The Girl Can't Help It.
It was a rock and roll film.
Yeah, it was a fluke, really. And for the first time, I was using my physical look for... to attract attention to me, and it was a claim to fame. And it wasn't anything that I'd ever done before, because we were taught not to do that anyway. It's vanity. And so it was brought to me. It wasn't anything I thought of to do on my own. You know, some guys who were, who were very appreciative and ambitious for a career for me and thought I could make a lot of money as a personality and as a singer, as long as I made peace with the fact that they said I couldn't sing.
Oh, they didn't like your singing?
They did. They told me I wasn't really a great singer at all. I just looked good, you know?
That's really funny.
It is. Now, but...
right now. Yeah, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. But I suffered from it.
Well,
it caused me some problems.
Did it make you insecure to have the people who were managing you think that you weren't very good at what you did?
Well, yes, it didn't help me any. I remember saying once to this beautiful man, he was a great songwriter and taught me a lot. And I said to him, you know, I have the feeling you people are robbing me of my individuality. He said to me, you don't have any individuality, but you will if you take direction. Well, he forgot who he was talking to, because he was one of the ones who told me that I could really think, and that he had all this admiration for me. But anyway, all of that is in the past. I wouldn't give up any of it, because I learned how to be whatever it is I am now.
Did it affect your relationship with men to be... sexy kitten on stage?
Because they believe, men and women, we all believe what we see on the screen. And people thought I was this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I played that role. Why would they think anything else? So I went from there to this warrior woman. And that would befuddle everybody too, because they thought, "Oh, why don't you shut up?" I think I've had that said to me more than anything in the world over the years when I was younger. You talk too much. Shut up. Don't rock the boat. Even though they're miserable, people are miserable, they'll tell you this, but you're not supposed to say anything about it. So when I discovered that there was the world of the artist, it saved my life, because I could strive to be individual, and as best as I could be, I didn't have to have money. I didn't have to have anything except my life. And I went for that, and I'm glad I did.
How did you discover the world of the artist from the world of the supper club?
Max Roach had a lot to do with it. He wasn't the only artist I met, though, actually. There was Benny Carter, who I did my first album with, and Bob Russell, who named me Abby Lincoln, was a great artist and songwriter. But Max brought me to this music that they call jazz and introduced me to these great musicians and singers who I probably wouldn't have met, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. I didn't get a chance to meet Charlie Parker because he passed away before I got to New York City.
My guest is singer Abby Lincoln. She has a new album called Devil's Got Your Tongue. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I guess the singer Abby Lincoln. You said that when you discovered jazz in the world of the artist that you turned into a woman warrior.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you were like as the woman warrior then.
Well, the first thing I did, I just started to wear my hair natural. That was a crime in 1958. A black woman wasn't supposed to show that she had hair like she had. It was a disgrace to have this kind of hair that they call all these crazy names. So I just glorified my existence. And I said, this is me, and this is my beautiful self, you know? The beauticians thought I was going to ruin their business. They did. They said I was after their business, and a lot of people said things. And I started singing songs that were more social. I started writing songs. And I found songs that would express what was in my heart. Because, you know, Billie Holiday was like this. She didn't sing inane things. She sang about the life that she lived. She may have been masochistic and all these things, but she sang Strange Fruit. And God bless the child that's got his own. It's the same reason they remember Bessie Smith, because these were social singers. They weren't just, it wasn't self-aggrandizement standing in front of people saying how great I am. But they were singing songs about the people's lives.
I want to play a recording that you made of a song very associated with Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And it's a very masochistic song, Don't Explain. But it's a beautiful song, nevertheless. You know.
Yes, forgiving.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful melody, and I love the way you sing it.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit before we hear it about the influence Billie Holiday had on you. I think you're a very different singer than she is, although I hear the influence that she's had on you. But tell me a bit about that influence, and also if you knew her, if you met her.
I met her when I was about 23 in Honolulu, and she came to the bar where I was working. It was probably to get away from where she was working, because the place was jammed with people. Anyway, she came to see me a couple of times, and I'd run to catch her show, and I saw her magic on the stage, this beautiful woman who would stand perfectly still with her hands, like she was like a doll, and her eyes would slide from one side of the room to the other, and the room was perfectly still. And I fell further in love with her. This was my... Because I was singing a lot of songs that she sang already from that I learned on the radio. But Billie Holiday was always honest. She didn't bend a note to make her voice sound good. It was in conversation that she sang. And she was sincere and honest, and she never made a record for money. She never raped anybody's career. And to me, she's the greatest singer of her era. I'm not the only one who feels this.
So do you think what you learned from Billie Holiday wasn't how to phrase as much as it was that you should be yourself?
Yes. Yes.
Let's hear your recording of Don't Explain, back from 1957, from your album That's Him, your first jazz recording.
Hush now, don't explain. Just say you'll remain. I'm glad you're back. Don't explain. Hush now. Don't explain. You're my joy and pain. Skip that lipstick. Don't explain.
That's Abby Lincoln singing Don't Explain. You and Max Roach got married during mm-hmm. the period that you were recording together.
Yes.
How did you like married life? And I'm wondering if your career ended up taking a back seat at all during
no,
the marriage.
No, he's a great artist and would never ask another artist to do that.
Uh-huh.
But marriage is the pit. You know why?
Why?
Because I'm a polygamous woman. I don't want him to be everything to a man. And I don't want him trying being everything to me. He's got his mother. I want to know if he loves his mother first. I want to know if he loves his first wife, if he got along with her or if he gets along with her. I just don't like this approach to marriage, and I will never do it again. I don't want to be that to anybody. I don't want anybody coming into my bedroom as if it's theirs. I have to have my own space, and I expect him to have his own. If he doesn't know how to have his own space, I don't want him around me.
So never again.
No, not that style.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. One of the songs of yours that you started singing when you began recording again in the late 70s was a song called Throw It Away. The lyric is about how you can throw something away because you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you.
I found this song. I used to throw the changes.
In the I Ching.
The I Ching, yeah. Oscar Brown Jr. introduced me to this oracle. So... And one day I threw this change and I heard this thought. So I just wrote it. I elaborated on it and wrote it.
Were you thinking of things that you thought you had thrown away?
But we all have to throw things away, you know? I had thrown away my marriage, my career, everything. Because this is the way it is. And we eventually you have to throw your body away. You die and you can't take it with you. So there's nothing here that really belongs to us, hardly, except for work. I know that is mine. Your children are not even yours. There's very little that belongs to us in this world. And a song is mine. If 100 years from today, if anybody hears the song, they'll know that I wrote it. So I figure those are the things that are mine. And not somebody.
When you sing now, do you feel comfortable on stage?
Yes. For many years, it's the most comfortable thing in the world to do. I'm not nervous. I'm not scared. I come to do something, to say something, and it's my first nature.
On the liner notes of one of your early records, someone quotes Thelonious Monk as having said to you the first time he saw you sing, "I like the way you stand."
No, he never said anything like that to me. Thelonious Monk wouldn't say anything like that to anybody in the first place. He doesn't give a damn about the way you stand. Excuse me, Lord. Thelonious Monk said to me, after listening to the words that I had written to his song, Blue Monk, he said to me, he came to where I was and whispered in my ear, "Don't be so perfect." And I said to Max Roach, "You know what Thelonious said to me?" He said, "Don't be so perfect." What did he mean? And Roach said, "He means make a mistake." And I didn't know what either one of them were talking about.
So how do you interpret that now?
It means that you must reach for something. You have to reach for the sky. If you don't make it, at least you reached for it. So your voice cracked, but you reached for it. You don't play safe. It's not safe, Jones. You take a chance on making a mistake. That's what they meant. And I do. I've learned to sing like that. Because I'm the human being. And even if it doesn't work, it's not wrong. If I didn't achieve what I meant to, it's okay. It's all right, because, I mean, I tried for it. Yeah.
Well, I just saw you sing in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and it was a great performance.
Thank you.
And I don't know, it seems like when I see you on stage that you really are feeling the material that you sing. You're not falling back on professionalism or show business or anything. You seem to really be reaching inside each time you perform.
That's true. It's the way of the music. Thelonious Monk would be drenched in perspiration and absolutely possessed. Nina Simone, Billie Holiday, and Charlie Parker, even though I didn't see him, but I hear it in his music. It's a possession. It's the muse. They talk about the muse. I'm possessed of a muse, and I belong to her, and she belongs to me. And as long as I sing and I am real and I do nothing to betray the trust, this is what I do. And it's a wonderful experience to come to the stage and to know that everything is all right.
It sounds like you think that if you betrayed the trust of your muse, that your muse would abandon you.
Yes, they do. They don't need anybody. They can sing whistle around the corner. They can babble in the brook. They don't need anybody. If you don't come real, they don't come and visit you. They come to visit sincerity and innocence and that one. You have to have this spirit yourself. To know that we are great people, and this is part of our life, this is part of our spirit, music. And to sing with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, the way they do in the churches. That's where Aretha Franklin came from, where they sing for the reverence of the gods that they choose to worship. I didn't come from the church, and... I see God through my mother and my father and my relatives. And when I come to the stages with reverence for myself, for my life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Abby Lincoln, her latest album is called Devil's Got Your Tongue. Our interview was recorded in June. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Long ago, falling shadows sent you on the run, and you learned to hide and sneak, running from the sun. Many, many things have changed, many songs were sung, but today, it's sad to say, the devil's got your tongue. Dancing with the devil.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a singer whose phrasing and understanding of a song just gets better over time, the great Tony Bennett. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest gender-bending film, The Ballad of Little Joe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton is meeting this evening with experts on health care to put the finishing touches on his plan to reform the nation's health care system. Meanwhile, the administration is working on how to sell the plan to Congress. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Today, President Clinton said he felt good about being able to generate bipartisan support for health care reform. He has been careful to put elements in his plan that Republicans are bound to like. No limits on what doctors, hospitals, and drug companies can charge, for example, and no new taxes besides so-called sin taxes. But already, those sin taxes have run into some resistance from Southern politicians who object to a tax on cigarettes. So the administration plans to link the cigarette tax to financing expanded benefits for Medicare recipients. That way, a politician who fights the cigarette tax will also be fighting politically powerful older people. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The PLO's mainstream Fatah faction is holding a critical meeting tonight on whether to approve an agreement with Israel on Palestinian self-rule. Sources say PLO leader Yasser Arafat is talking to opponents of the plan. They say at least 4 of 12 Central Committee members are uneasy about the deal. Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip say Israeli troops shot and wounded 4 Arabs today during a protest against the agreement with Israel. Witnesses say soldiers fired on a group of more than 1,000 demonstrators who chanted, "Death to Israel, death to America." The Muslim Hamas movement said today it killed an Israeli soldier on Thursday to sabotage the agreement with Israel. Today the White House announced it's recruited a Republican, former Congressman Bill Frenzel, to help push the NAFTA free trade agreement through Congress. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Bill Frenzel, who was an influential member of the Ways and Means Committee when he served in the House, will join Chicago banker Bill Daley. They'll spearhead the administration's effort to push the NAFTA agreement through Congress. The treaty has the support of a majority of Republicans and business groups, but a majority of Democrats and organized labor opposes it. The NAFTA treaty is also receiving high-profile attacks from former presidential candidates Ross Perot, Jerry Brown, and Pat Buchanan. Perot is publishing a book outlining his argument that NAFTA will cost millions of American jobs. Today, the administration released a letter signed by more than 200 economists stating their support for the treaty. It called the plan a net positive for the United States in terms of job creation and overall economic growth. The White House plans to submit legislation implementing NAFTA to Congress in 2 weeks. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today in pre-holiday trading. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 8 points to close at 3633.93. Advancing issues led declines by a 10-9 margin. This is NPR. Michigan's Supreme Court ruled today that General Motors can start closing its Willow Run assembly plant in Ypsilanti. GM decided more than a year ago to shut Willow Run, but the town filed suit to keep the plant open. Ypsilanti officials said GM's acceptance of more than $13 million in tax breaks was an agreement to maintain Willow Run, but GM argued it made no such promise. The Labor Department today reported a drop in the nation's unemployment rate, but released other jobs figures that were less encouraging. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
Unemployment fell to 6.7% last month from 6.8% in July and 7% the month before that, as a survey of households showed a surge of 409,000 in the number employed, while the labor force grew just 300,000. But a survey of employers told a different tale. It revealed a 39,000 drop in non-farm payroll. Analysts had been looking for a substantial job increase. There was a loss of 42,000 factory jobs, confirming other signs of softness in manufacturing. Construction and government jobs were also down, while service jobs rose. Wall Street paid more attention to weakness in the payroll figures than to the drop in joblessness. The yield on 30-year Treasury bonds fell below 6% for the first time. Nancy Vandenhouten of Merrill Lynch said the truth lies somewhere in between the two conflicting sets of numbers. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
Former President George Bush will reportedly receive $100,000 to speak at a convention this weekend. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says Bush will give the keynote address at the Amway distributors meeting. In North Carolina, a gag order has been imposed in the case against two teenagers charged with killing James Jordan, father of basketball star Michael Jordan. The judge today told all lawyers and court personnel not to comment on the case. He also denied bond for the two 18-year-old suspects. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. As part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives, we're featuring a 1991 conversation with Tony Bennett. Some singers lose their touch as they get older, but Bennett is in some ways a better singer now than he was in the 50s and 60s when he had all his hits. His voice might have lost some of its power and range, but the years have brought a depth and beauty of phrasing that would be hard to surpass. One turning point in his career was his 1975 album of duets with Bill Evans. With this sensitive jazz pianist behind him instead of pop arrangements, you could really hear what Bennett could do with a song.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss.
Tony Bennett's first record was Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You almost wouldn't recognize his voice. It was a semi-operatic performance with lots of big high notes. I asked him if there were opera records around his house when he was growing up.
There really were, because my brother was a magnificent prodigy. He was a very wonderful opera singer. They called him the Little Caruso. He was 13 and sang solo spots in the Metropolitan Opera. And did radio shows in those days. That was the highest ratings. The shows were big. And he was always a guest artist on very big radio shows. And we all loved opera in my home. And it was during the Depression. And we'd buy these Caruso records and Gigli, and all these magnificent singers, Richard Tucker, and enjoy the way they sang.
So if your brother was the Little Caruso, what were you?
Well, I was the comedian because I had to compete somehow for all that attention. And I imitated Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor and did imitations of them. And it used to break my relatives up every Sunday. They'd make a circle around my sister, my brother, and myself, and we would entertain them. And we couldn't wait for that Sunday. It was so much fun and so much love was given to us and encouragement.
Now, your father died when you were 9. How did your mother raise the money, earn the money to bring up the children?
Well, she was an amazing lady because she was a seamstress and she worked so hard and raised 3 children. My older sister helped her so much and raised 2 boys and was, we just were very close and very... Well, it was just the most beautiful home life that you could ever dream of. And it was different. It was sad not to have a father and very confusing, but it's funny. It just shows you when people love one another how many things really work out.
How old were you when you had to go out and work for a living?
I was about 15 when I first started. I started out as a singing waiter, and in the Pheasant Tavern in Astoria, which is now Ricardo's.
So you had to sing in between serving or sing while you were serving?
Well, yeah, both. It was fun. It was almost chaplain-esque, you know, because I had two Irish waiters, and they were great, jolly type guys, and always wanted to encourage me, and I'd get a request to sing I'll Get By or a song like that, and I'd run into the kitchen to get, I know if I sang it, I'd get an extra tip, so they'd teach it to me just right on the spot, and I'd come out singing it. And I used to love doing that. You know, it was just so much fun every weekend when I sang there.
You had an uncle, I think, who was in vaudeville. Did your uncle's stories make you want to go into show business? Did it seem like fun to you?
Well, you know, he was a very wise psychologist as far as I'm concerned, because his name was Dick Gordon, and Dick Sarace, but his stage name was Dick Gordon. And he was really my father, and I didn't know it. I mean, he would just say, after supper, why don't you come and meet me under the lamppost on the street corner? And he would just hang out and talk to me and tell me these legends. And what an influence he was, because he kind of gave me all the rules and what kind of person I should be if I go into show business. And he warned me that, he said, I don't think you're ever going to make it because you have a rasp in your voice. He said, and if you're a singer, you're not going to make it if you sing. And so he just gave me a fine tuning as to what attitude I should have when I perform and how careful I really have to be about everything.
Well, how did telling you had a rasp in your voice and therefore you'd never make it as a singer help you?
Well, John Barrymore once said, the harder the slap, the greater the artist.
Were you self-conscious about this thing that your uncle had pointed out to you?
Did absolutely. I mean, I taught how to... Louis Belson, the great drummer, you know, Pearl Bailey's husband, the late Pearl Bailey, he kind of taught me how to breathe, and so that when I sing, the rasp is not heard at all. And it's just a matter of breathing before you take before a phrase that you sing, you see.
Now, you were in the military in World War II.
I was in the infantry, yes.
Did you sing with a band during that?
After the war, I joined. There was a fantastic story, you know, about Major Lutkoff, who kind of saved me because a racial prejudice situation jumped off, and it was terrible in my life. And it just changed my life, completely and taught me how to behave to my fellow man, because I went to school with a gentleman called Frank Smith, and he was a wonderful friend, black musician, and he and I used to have so much fun together in New York City, and we had a vocal group at the High School of Industrial Art, where I was studying art, and when I was allowed one guest for Thanksgiving at the Truman Hotel in Mannheim, Germany, after the war was over. And I went to his Baptist church and went to Mass with him, and we had a pleasant time. And I said, you're allowed to be my guest. Come and have Thanksgiving dinner with me. Well, there was a Southern bigot who was a lieutenant. And he, when I came up out of the restaurant, we were having fun. He came and called me Benedetto. He said, come over here. And he took a razor blade and slashed my corporal things off my arm and spit on it and threw it on the floor and sent me to Graves Registration, where you dig up bodies. And it was horrible. And Major Letkoff saved me. He heard about the incident and took me away from there right away and made me librarian for a wonderful orchestra that was... conducted by Lynn Arison, the warrant officer, and made me the librarian and singer for this beautiful American Forces Network Orchestra.
So as punishment, you were supposed to find the wounded and the dead and bury the dead?
Yes.
How long did you have to do that?
For 2.5 weeks. It was horrible. You know, it was just a horrible thing in my life, and I've never gotten over it. And man's inhumanity, man, is very important to me personally.
We're featuring a 1991 interview with Tony Bennett. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Tony Bennett is my guest. You are really among the most respected singers today, and certainly of your generation. And, I mean, among the things you're respected for is not only the beauty of your voice and the depth of your phrasing, but also your repertoire, your choice of songs, your understanding of what makes a song good. In the 50s and 60s, up until around 1965, you had so many records on the charts. You know, you were recording about three albums a year, and a lot of the singles were big hits on the charts. Your last chart hit was in 1965, If I Ruled the World. And after that, rock and roll really took off, you know, monopolized the charts pretty much. what were those years in the latter part of the 60s like for you? Were you trying very hard to land something else on the charts, or had
no.
you pretty much given up on
no,
that?
I kind of walked away from it. I thought it was, I saw it as a fiasco. It became more and more Madison Avenue programming, you know, just a marketing thing. I've got this wonderful craving, you know, a friend of mine, John Brasher, he's a dancer, and he said to me, God, you paint every day. He said, why don't you stretch out and make it an occupation? So about 35 years ago, I just took him up on that, and I started painting and going toward selling my paintings and all that and having gallery showings. And then it allowed me to become a performer because I always had deadlines up until then. I had to do, like you say, three albums a year and hit singles and all that. And I was really just into the record business. And I just walked away from it. I personally, I wasn't rejected. I was the one who decided to take a walk. And what happened was very helpful. I learned that things work out for the best because what happened is I learned how to perform on stage a lot better. Now that I'm recording, my son Danny was responsible for getting a contract where they trust me and I just hand in the record. And thank God for him because it's allowed me the freedom to just express myself freely. And I'm very happy with the recording scene in my personal life right now.
You are a singer who, it seems to me, keeps getting deeper into songs as you, the longer you sing.
Right.
That your phrasing just seems to become, to have more emotional depth all the time.
You know why that happened? I think I have the answer to that. It's so funny when I used to sit around the house and watch my mom, who just made one dress after another, working on a record-breaking time to sew as many dresses as she can so she'd make a little more money for us to live by. And that every once in a while she would stay very calm and very concentrated on what she was doing. But every once in a while she'd get angered and she would take a dress and throw it over her shoulder and she'd say, don't have me work on a bad dress. She said, if you give me a good dress, I don't mind doing this. She said, but don't have me ever work on a bad dress, on a cheap dress. And that's why I've just decided never to compromise. I think that's what it came from. I saw that, you know, she was able to sustain because she stayed with good quality. And I asked Sinatra one time, I said, why do you think that we've sustained so long through the years? He said, that's because we stayed with good songs. So I think when you do something of quality, somehow or other, you may not be on top of the charts, but you're always respected and you always have a place in society by doing something that's made very well.
How do you think getting older is changing your voice? And if your voice is changing, how do you think that's changing how you approach a song and how you phrase the lyrics?
Yeah, well, Bobby Hackett taught me to work on bel canto scales every day, and so I've been able to obtain four or five more notes on the bottom of my register. So now I'm a baritone tenor, and I take good care of my voice and myself.
How do you work through a song when you decided to do a new one? Do you have your music director at the piano and do you work it through with him first?
Well, I try to save him a lot of time, so when I first hear a song, I'll have him put it on tape for me, a little cassette, and then I just learn it that way so that we don't have to go over and over it in the studio. And then when I learn it, then I start doing it in front of an audience and get an audience reaction. Let's see how the audience likes it. And then if they like it and I like it, and I think, I always say to myself, if this is going to become a hit, will I be able to enjoy this song by singing it every night? And that's the test I give it. It's a tough test, but it has to have a very musical structure to it, so that if I have to sing a song every night, it's something that I won't ever mind doing.
I guess some singers are really haunted by their hits. They never really like the song, and now they're forced to sing it one way or another every time they perform.
Right, and that's incorrect. You know, it shouldn't. That's when you pick an inferior song. If you have a good song, you don't mind doing it every night.
Tony Bennett, recorded in 1991.
They say that falling in love is wonderful. It's wonderful, so they say. And with a moon up above, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, so they tell me. I can't recall who said it. I know I never read it. I only know they tell me that love is grand. And the thing that's known as romance is wonderful, wonderful in every way. So they say.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have new figures that say that unemployment is down, but payrolls are also down. We'll talk about how that might be, and the attitude of Americans toward their work in a new study. We also will be talking about central Bosnia, where there's additional fighting. Scott Simon has a piece on black humor in Sarajevo, something that helps the people there keep going. There is a truth squad being launched to keep the North American free trade debate honest from the president's point of view. And we will talk about school lunches and ranch romance.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maggie Greenwald has been working in the movie business a long time, first as an actress, dancer, and editor, then as a writer-director. But her first two films, Home Remedy and The Kill-Off, barely made their way into release. Now a lot of people are talking about her new Western, The Ballad of Little Joe. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see why.
Politically correct Westerns are nothing new, of course. Even the great John Ford tried to atone for his sins against the American Indian by making the film Cheyenne Autumn in 1964. And in 1990, the most politically correct Western of them all, Dances with Wolves, won a mantleful of Academy Awards. Maggie Greenwald's handsome, carefully made film, The Ballad of Little Joe, may not be about the oppression of the Indians, but it's PC in spades. It's about the oppression of women, and it's based on what the film calls a real life. Susie Amos plays Josephine Monahan, a well-bred Eastern girl who's kicked out of her rich family when she has an illegitimate child. Why she decides that her only alternative is to head to a godforsaken Western mining camp is never quite clear. What is clear is that a woman alone among the tumbleweeds is a target for rapists, white slavers, and all manner of ornery varmint. It's also not clear why the other women in the mining camp don't run into the same trouble, even the young and pretty one who waitresses at the local saloon, but no matter. Josephine decides the only solution is to become a guy named Little Joe. She cuts her hair off, outfits herself in men's clothes, and gashes a horrendous scar into the side of her face. Quite unnecessarily, one feels, since scar or no scar, she still looks like a pretty young debutante in cowboy togs. Nevertheless, her new disguise manages to fool all the other galoots in town, at least for a while. Every now and then, the town folk do wonder why Little Joe doesn't take part in certain group activities, especially when the local prostitute comes to town. And pretty soon, Joe realizes that her life would be safer in isolation. So she buys a piece of land out in the middle of nowhere and builds a ranch on it. All goes well until she hires a crippled but good-looking Chinese servant. His name is Tin Man, and he's played by David Chung. And when he goes to work for her, pointedly cooking and cleaning while Joe does the so-called man's work, she can't help finding him attractive. Naturally, he figures out that his new master is really his mistress. And when he does, the two fall in love. Still, their affair and her real gender have to be kept secret. As Joe explains to Tin Man, folks in the mining camp don't much like being fooled.
What do you think would happen if they found out about me? Little Joe Monahan turns out to be a woman and she's lovers with an ailing Chinaman. They'd kill us.
Unquestionably. Brutally.
Why can't we just live as we are?
I want peace for the last years of my life. You found it living as a man. I found it living with you.
Corny? Messagey? You bet. And Maggie Greenwald isn't one to keep things subtle. She wants to make sure we get it, as the saying goes. In the Old West, women were treated as chattel, and they shouldn't have been, gall darn it. Everyone agree? Yup. Everyone agree even without seeing the movie? Yup. Any reason to see the movie? Nope.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Chris Fraley, Bob Alls, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reef is our intern. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Have a great holiday weekend.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor and self-described square, Leslie Nielsen, about how he came to star in comedies that spoofed the dramas he used to make. And satirist Harry Shearer tells us about his formative years working with Jack Benny, Mel Blanc, and Abbott and Costello. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.